Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Cello Still Sings, a generational story of the Holocaust and of the transformative power of music, by Janet Horvath, narrated by Samantha Dez. Publisher's note: this audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit tantor.com and type The Cello Still Sings into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page. Then, under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code CONCERT. And then, click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. All images, a genocide dictionary, and the appendix can be found in the bonus material. Forward. The irrepressible and inspirational conductor, composer, pianist, and unconsecrated rabbi Leonard Bernstein declared in one of his captivating books that music can name the unnameable and communicate the unknowable, to which he might well have added, and redeem the unspeakable. Lenny, as he was known far and wide, came face to face with the remnants of the unspeakable in the spring of 1948, when, as a 29-year-old on the cusp of worldwide adulation, he conducted an ensemble in Landsberg, Germany, known, with a dollop of understated irony, as the ex-concentration camp orchestra. The performances took place within the confines of a displaced persons camp, its inmates slash musicians still considered stateless and unrooted 3 years after the end of the war that had consigned them all for months within the hellish walls of Auschwitz and Dachau, Belsen and Theresienstadt and Mauthausen, and all the other facilities in Eastern Europe whose names continue to sound as heavy, tolling bells of the heart. In a letter home, Lenny relates that he was presented with a concentration camp uniform as a gift. I was received by parades of kids with flowers, then conducted a 20-piece orchestra, and cried my eyes out. The consequences of that emotional music-making serve as brackets to the remarkable tale told in this book by cellist Janet Horvath. Her father, Gyuri, also played the cello in his native Hungary before enduring slave labor in Yugoslavia. His post-war wanderings led him eventually to that Landsberg DP camp and a place in the very orchestra conducted by Bernstein in 1948. 70 years later, his daughter was among the musicians who memorialized the ex-concentration camp orchestra with a concert in Landsberg in which she performed the haunting setting by Max Bruch of the Kol Nidre, the solemn prayer that begins the holy service of Yom Kippur every year. For Janet Horvath, that performance offered, and ultimately provided, a deep emotional catharsis. Just the sort of purification and cleansing of a soul seared and scorched by tragedy envisioned by Aristotle when he coined the term 2,300 years ago. For most, if not all, of her adult life, she has been wrestling with the ramifications of being a member of the second generation, a child of survivors of the Holocaust. It's a condition that I recognize immediately within the first pages of her story. My parents escaped Nazi Germany relatively unscathed, having survived until the spring of 1941, performing with an all-Jewish performing arts organization that was maintained by Joseph Goebbels as a key cog in the machinery of his Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda. But their families remained behind in the old world, to be murdered in Auschwitz, in Theresienstadt, in Riga, in Trofniki, leaving my parents, George and Rosemary, to come to terms with their losses via silence and guilt and occasional bouts of rage. How familiar do Janet's memories of her father's need for punctuality, his obsessive concern with order, ring true for me. When I read about Janet's deep-seated, lifelong disquiet about revealing myself as a Jew, how quickly does a clearly etched memory arise within me? My father, by this time, was in his 90s and suffering from dementia. That summer morning, when dressing, I had thrown on the t-shirt that lay at the top of the pile, not paying attention to the fact that the shirt clearly bore the words, Pasadena Jewish Book Festival. When I visited my father at his elder care facility, his first words, uttered in a conspiratorial whisper, were, "You didn't actually wear that out on the street, did you?" Janet's declaration that, as the living, breathing embodiment of survival, I tried not to cause my parents further pain, rings true for every member of the second generation. One of my friends, a daughter of survivors, recalls the time when, at age 7, she fell off her bicycle and badly skinned her knee. But rather than limp home crying to her parents, she sneaked up the stairs to the bathroom to tend to her injury herself. "Even at that young age," she recalls, "I knew that something bad had happened to them and that I shouldn't trouble them with something as piddling as a skinned knee." But to be a 2G, as the shorthand has it, is also to revel in the discoveries of a religious and cultural tradition that our parents may have feared to explore with us, as was the case in my secular household growing up. Even the humble pomegranate, Janet writes, can bear symbolic weight. According to Jewish tradition, there are 613 seeds in a single pomegranate, each one representing a commandment one must honor in order to live a righteous life. The Jewish people, in spite of centuries of persecution, she continues, have achieved the fertility and renewal promised by the pomegranate. From its seeds has grown a generation, my generation, raised by Holocaust survivors, who continue to pursue good and righteous behavior. In my own rambling pursuit of my 2G identity, I underwent a 20-month program of study, discussion, and learning that culminated in the spring of 2008 with my becoming a son of the commandment, a bar mitzvah boy, at the age of 55. Ultimately, though, what our generation has come to know, and as this book reveals, is the importance of providing comfort, love, and understanding to the rapidly disappearing members of that first generation of sufferers and survivors, in an echo of the Duke of Albany's words at the end of King Lear, "The oldest hath borne most. We that are young shall never see so much, nor live so long." Martin Goldsmith. Author's note. We children of Holocaust survivors have needed a lifetime to process the genetic trauma passed down upon us. Quite aware we're alive today by virtue of our parents' unlikely survival, our internal gauge makes it visceral, as if we'd been there ourselves experiencing the horrors. We have relived the experiences throughout our lives, if only in our imaginations. Hence, I have chosen to write the text in the entr'actes, the reflection and musings of my childhood, in the present tense, as it is perennially present for me. Hungarian is a complex language. Several entries include the translations. The letters K-A, ka, added to the end of a name mean little. Janetka becomes little Janet. Robika becomes little Robert. The letters K-E with an acute accent, M, came, added to the end of a name mean my little. Janet came becomes my little Janet. My father also called me Mutzikam, a Hungarian endearment which can be translated to my little sweetheart. Prologue. The Spirit of Ancestors in Germany. May 2018. There are no bodies here, only names engraved on barren slabs and forlorn pillars. There's a rail car, which locks from the outside, and a crumbling plaque with a dedication, Unbekannter, grave of thousands unknown. I climb further on an overgrown path, wondering what or who I have tread upon. In the distance, a lone memorial surrounded in stones from a son in memory of his father. Feeling unnerved with pinpricks of doubt, I retrace my steps to the medieval city on the lake, Landsberg am Lech. Decorative multicolored facades line the cobblestone streets. Scattered throughout the town square, orange, blue, and green umbrellas shelter tables overflowing with Wiener Schnitzel, marzipan cookies, apple strudel, and mugs of dark beer. I hear laughter. For the townspeople, the decades-old memorials must fade into the background. They are expecting me. I hurry back to the hotel, slip on my gown, and make my way to the theater, where a woman ushers me to a bare-bones cubicle. Gray walls, gray floor, a clothes rack without hangers. Even though there's no room for more than 3 steps in either direction, I start to pace. Perhaps the lightheadedness will dissipate. The anticipation before making an entrance is always daunting, but this is no ordinary concert. After months of planning, I am about to play one of the most hallowed works of Jewish liturgy, Kol Nidre, in Germany, in the very spot my father performed with a group of Holocaust survivors in 1948, 70 years ago to the day. Mustering the courage to open the door, I peer down bleak cement stairs. A din of voices drift upward from the stalls. The opening gala is in full swing, and laughter and applause can be heard coming from the stage. The babble rouses me. It's time to warm up. Pressing the strings, oscillating slowly between notes, I feel the familiar sensation in my fingertips, the skin softening as the metal meets the ebony fingerboard, each finger curved and firm. A glorious resonance emanates. I try to focus on setting the tone for the evening, confident music might clear the haze of distrust. But I can't help thinking about my father, remembering that for most of my life, he suppressed his story. How mistaken I had been. The volatility, paranoia, and the delicate beauty of his music were not signs of weakness, but belied resilience. In a state of suspension, I adjust the tautness of my bow and invoke his performance of the lament, shaping the opening motif. D, 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 C sharp, C sharp, C sharp, A. Dark sounds fill my every pore, like the keening of an aimless soul. I'm interrupted by a knock on the door, my summons. Clutching the cello, I stand up. Then carefully maneuver down the narrow half-lit stairway. Emerging from behind the sapphire velvet curtain, I take the stage, the strong spirit of ancestors beside me. Part 1. Unexpected Revelations. George's, Judy's, Story. Music expresses that which cannot be said and on which it is impossible to be silent. Victor Hugo, 1802 to 1885. 1. A Concert with Leonard Bernstein in May 1948. He'd already called 3 times that morning. Janet came, then you're coming. With a firm grip on the steering wheel, I slalomed the car forward on black, ice-covered roads toward my father's high-rise. The dense traffic and the treacherous surfaces hindered my progress. I chose a circuitous route, unplowed but easier to negotiate. With shoulders raised to my ears, I slid into a parking spot and braced myself for the cold trek to the front door. My elevated pulse didn't surprise me. The dusky sky threatened more sleet, and I was nearly late. The elevator door opened onto the 14th floor. And there stood my father, clean-shaven, waiting in his camel hair coat and jaunty black chapeau. Underneath, as always for any outing, he was dressed in a suit, a gray pinstriped one with a crisp tailored shirt, multicolored matching silk tie, leather shoes tied just so. Raising his unruly eyebrows, now speckled with gray, he said with a twinkle in his eyes, "Janet came. Where were you so long?" We embraced and made our way painstakingly into the elevator. My father, at 87, was still sharp, critical, astute. His old-world European elegance and high standards of behavior were unchanged, his taste in fashion, art, and cuisine uncompromised, and his thick Hungarian accent undiminished. Still, the least slight could set him aflame. He leaned precariously on his walker. When had his posture become so stooped, his physique so frail? He would often forget his unsteadiness, which had resulted in sudden falls. As we left the building, buffeted in the sub-zero wind tunnel, I was grateful I hadn't chosen this location for my parents, because I would never have heard the end of it. My father loved all things beautiful. He selected this building because of the striking gold fixtures in the bathroom and contemporary marble-tiled floors. The lobby of the multi-story condominium located on Yonge Street, the main north-south corridor of Toronto, exudes refinement with its leather furniture, floor-to-ceiling mirrors, and luxuriant plants, a monolith above the bustling street. But the steep incline between the parking lot and the entryway is difficult even for young people to negotiate. The first week my parents lived there, my father fell flat on his face, breaking his nose. A superstitious man, he decided the place was cursed. Leaning into the wind, I tightened my hold on him. We lumbered to the car, then I reminded him to place his behind in first and to lower his head so he wouldn't bump it on the way in. I bent down to grab his legs and hoisted them into the car. Success. No bruises or breaks this time. Once I had heaved the walker into the trunk, I settled into the driver's side, sighing audibly in anticipation of the tedious drive to yet another doctor's appointment. This time, the neurologist, for his Parkinson's disease symptoms. "Watch how you are driving, Janet Game." Still uneasy, I focused on the rugged inflection of his voice, the sound of his fingers tapping on the center console. Cello-playing fingers need to be supple. He was always practicing, even without the instrument, even on an armrest, even now that he no longer played. This lifelong mannerism temporarily impeded the oscillating tremor in his limbs. I considered harmless subjects for conversation and settled on music. He loved to talk shop. My orchestra was preparing a festival to honor Leonard Bernstein, the legendary maestro, educator, and pianist, bad boy, and superstar. The genius who composed West Side Story, who for nearly half a century conducted the New York Philharmonic. Despite more than three decades of cello playing, I never crossed paths with Bernstein. But my father, a wonderful cellist in his day, performed under the batons of the greatest conductors as a member of first the Budapest Symphony and then the Toronto Symphony. He was quite hard of hearing by then, so I hollered, "Papa, did you ever play with Leonard Bernstein?" The tapping stopped. His skin paled. He shifted in his seat, rubbed his rheumy eyes, and placed the palm of his hand on his cheek. Several moments passed. Should I pull over? I decided to remain quiet, concentrating on the road, when a whoosh of air escaped from his lungs. "Yes," he said. "It was very hot day. He came to conduct Jewish orchestra in DP camps in 1948, after war. He played George Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue on piano. He was just a kid and was just fantastic. Gentlemen, he said, let's take off our jackets and roll up our sleeves. We are just schwitzing." My father laughed. "I talked to him in German, I said, I won't come to America. So warm, Bernstein was. He said, I am great Jewish musician. I should go to Palestine. Perspiration oozed down my neck. Resisting the urge to break, I considered what to do. He'd never told me this story before, or others. Ice pellets strafed the car, and my father, a defiantly taciturn man, had just disclosed a long-held secret. Hoping for more, hoping not to intrude, I kept driving. He always remembered the music. A Weber overture preceded Rhapsody in Blue, and a beautiful young girl named Henia thrilled the audience with Yiddish and Hebrew songs. Chaim Arbeitmann, fantastic violinist, played solo. What a tone! Younger than me, maybe 18 he was. He changed his name when he came to America to Arben, David Arben. He was accepted by Philadelphia Orchestra, my father said proudly, as if it was his own accomplishment. We played for 5,000 people. Everybody needed music, needed to hear Bernstein. My father's face glowed as he evoked Bernstein, his luxuriant hair tumbling down his brow, his vivid personality, his exuberant gestures. And during the passion-infused piano playing of Rhapsody in Blue, his body swaying for emphasis, he led the ensemble with a mere nod of his head, a swivel of his hips, a shrug of his shoulders. My father recalled the healing power of the music, not the hardship and the deprivation of the times. Like other Holocaust survivors, Papa rarely, if ever, alluded to his experiences during or after the war. What had my question unleashed? Thoughts sprinted through my mind. How and when did they go to Germany, of all places? Was my mother there too? Were they displaced persons? Why had he never before boasted about the encounter with Bernstein? But Papa, how did you... My father shrank in his seat and huddled closer to the passenger door. He shook his head, his eyes turned grave. Tapping and staring straight ahead, he reverted to silence. As a child, I knew not to ask questions. After the ravages of the war, my parents buried the memories of who and what they were before, silencing the past in order to live. My younger brother, Robert, and I grew up in Toronto in the 1960s, bewildered by the constant intensity of our parents' emotions. When they spoke, we listened. It never occurred to us not to. We tried to be the most well-behaved children. Still, my father's displeasure could churn and foam in his throat and bubble over into ear-splitting screams. We often wondered what we'd done to trigger such anger. My father's English was different, hesitant, and strongly accented. The th and wa sounds unpronounceable. Long time not seen. How you keeping? And what taking so long? He'd say. By age 10, I was the official translator. My parents depended on me to make telephone calls, read and write letters, and explain American idioms, like necking and nincompoop. Papa didn't play baseball or watch football like most Canadian dads. He practiced the cello all day long. He played concerts at night and performed at weddings and funerals on the weekends. We often heard choking sounds at night. I knew other dads didn't cry like he did. Mama's sudden intake of breath conjured steely control. Never tell anyone you're Jewish, she'd say. Not allowed to play outside alone or to attend a sleepover, I wondered, why couldn't I be like other Canadian kids? Why couldn't I have peanut butter sandwiches on white bread for lunch, hang out at the mall, go sailing, date boys, even Jewish ones? I didn't want to be different. Even as an adult, I was fearful of what I might hear, fearful of emotions I might unleash. Whenever I thought about what my parents experienced, even for a moment, dread, obsession, and guilt simmered in a thick goulash. Grousing about being cold or tired, hungry or impatient, incensed or disappointed, brought self-recrimination. What are you complaining about? You're not in a concentration camp. My parents never spoke about it, yet nebulous memories, sinister visions, and stifled emotions infused the air. I remember a knock at our front door as my brother and I were drifting to sleep. We heard our parents' agitated voices in a flurry of Hungarian. Leaping out of bed, we rushed into our mother's arms. I started to cry. A knock on the door late at night could only mean catastrophe. My father sidled to the door. "Who is that?" "It's Phil," a voice said. "Your neighbor." My dad cracked the door open, squinting into the darkness. "Your headlights are on. I didn't mean to startle you." Phil apologized, although I could tell he wasn't sure why. My brother and I were mystified. Innocent as the encounter seemed, our parents' dread sucked us into the mire. I spent most of my life inhaling, rarely exhaling. After the conversation about Leonard Bernstein, and after I settled my father in his apartment that January evening, I rushed to my computer. Surely there must be some documentation for this notable event. My mind whirled. I wondered who the musicians were. How did they meet? Where did they get instruments, clothing, sheet music, and the strength to perform? And as preposterous as it sounds now, when my father indicated he played in an orchestra of survivors, I envisioned a full symphony orchestra with 100 musicians. The information practically leapt out at me from Leonard Bernstein's website. On May 10, 1948, Bernstein conducted at the Landsberg and Feldafing Displaced Persons (DP) camps in Bavaria, Germany, in the American zone, for thousands of Holocaust survivors, spectators, and American military personnel. Bernstein described the experience, noting the bedraggled appearance of the handful of musicians. My father was one of only 17 musicians, all survivors, who performed with Bernstein that day. Late into the night, I pursued further details, hoping for more leads. I came across a newspaper article, March 14, 2008. Leonard Bernstein, a musical tribute. The Israel Philharmonic and Tony Bennett applaud Leonard Bernstein. Several luminaries attended the event, among them Rita Lerner, a trustee of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City. She is quoted as saying, "My mother, Henny Dermashkin Gerko, had been accompanied by Leonard Bernstein in Munich in 1948. My mother sang Hebrew songs from the ghetto with the ex-concentration camp orchestra. Years later, she donated the printed program autographed by Bernstein to the Holocaust Museum. Despite the late hour, my fingers pummeled the keyboard. I emailed the museum. My father participated in a program with Leonard Bernstein in 1948. Might I come to see the signed program you have in your collection?" The response arrived the next day. "Yes, we have the autographed program. You can make an appointment to see it the next time you are in New York. But don't you want to see the eyewitness testimony of Mrs. Gerko on videotape and the photographs?" My husband was downstairs. "Howie," I shrieked, "they have photographs!" My first opportunity to travel to New York in 2009 would occur 4 months later, in May. I'd be on tour with the Minnesota Orchestra. In the meantime, the Museum of Jewish Heritage sent a licensing agreement for me to sign, which allowed me to procure a copy of the program. It faithfully represented the age and fragility of the original document, complete with folds, frayed edges, and cracks. My father had recalled the entire program exactly. The musical works performed were all familiar to me, but I needed the help of a German-speaking friend to translate the words, scrutinizing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?